Well, as we did on Friday, we're looking together at the history that John has given us about Jesus. John's account of Sunday morning starts and ends with a particular focus on what happened with Mary of Magdala. Magdala is a town up in Galilee, so we know that Mary's been a follower of Jesus since back then. She's been with him for a few years. We saw her on Friday, actually. She was at the cross when Jesus died. She saw Jesus cry out, "It is finished," and breathe no more. She'd have seen them take the spear and confirm his death. She'd likely have gone with Joseph and Nicodemus to lay Jesus' body in the tomb. Before the sun has come up, Mary is up and heading out to the tomb. We know from the other records that she's going out to put the spices and oils on the wrapped body of Jesus as part of the burial rituals. They would have done it on Friday, but given the rush to take the body down from the cross before the Sabbath, it appears there simply wasn't time before sundown. And as the full moon, no doubt, began to set in the west, being days after Passover, and as the sky began to lighten in the east, she's on her way. She got up early because she had this job to do, this important work, vital for honouring her master and her Lord. But I bet she went very disappointed, disillusioned, disheartened. Look at what it says. John chapter 20. You can find it on page 1074 in the Pew Bibles. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. Mary immediately knows something is wrong. There's only a handful of reasons why someone would remove that stone, and one of them is to do the job she's come to do on behalf of the disciples: give Jesus a proper burial. And so she jumps to the most likely conclusion. Verse 2, she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." It's a totally rational position to come to. There's nothing in the tomb except Jesus' body. And after the shock of his crucifixion, how horrible to think that someone might come and desecrate his body. Who would take it and why is a mystery. And so Simon and this other disciple, we know it must be John. This is how he refers to himself in his story. Simon, Peter and John, they set out to investigate. They run at full stride down to the tomb, and John peeps Peter to the tomb, and he looks in and he sees this remarkable detail. Look at verse 5. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in. I wonder what, Hercule Poirot would make of this. Or some other, famous detective. What would Columbo ask people about this? Do you want me to do my Columbo impression? One more question. There's one part of this case I just can't quite work out, and maybe you can help me. Why, when they took the body out of the tomb, why did they strip it naked first? Not the disciples, not the Jewish leaders, not some grave robber is going to waste time unwrapping the body at the scene of the crime. And surely, sneaking around with a dead body is going to be hard enough in a fairly populated area, let alone a naked dead body. So John, looking at this strange thing, and suddenly Peter gets there and he rushes past him and straight inside. And he notices the same thing, except it's even more detailed than that. Look at verse 6. And then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. That cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple who had reached the tomb first also went inside. He saw and believed. Peter might still be thinking about it, but John, he says he's seen enough. He reckons Jesus has done what he said he would do. He's laid down his life and taken it up again. A grave robber didn't take the clothes. Sorry, didn't take off those clothes. Jesus has risen again. But it's not a fully formed thought in John's mind. Neither man really gets what's happened or why it's happened. See, look at verse 9. They still do not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. See, even though John has started to believe that Jesus is risen, he still doesn't really get the full implications of why or the full implications of what it means. And it's going to take a few weeks for that to happen. Having seen all they can at the tomb, the two men head back. And having come back to the tomb, Mary is, well, she's succumbed to her grief. And she stands outside weeping. She hasn't heard from Peter and John. And she decides she's going to see what's going on. And what she sees is much more convincing than simply grave clothes. It says, as she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb. And in verse 12, and saw two angels in white, seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." Do you notice how she doesn't think these are angels? She thinks there's two men in there and she's just having this normal conversation with them. And then there's another man behind her in verse 14. At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realize that it was Jesus. And again, she gets asked, why is she crying? Verse 15, "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it that you are looking for?" Listen to the next five words. I think they're astounding. The next five words that John writes, thinking he was the gardener. Mary doesn't see a gardener and think, oh, that must be Jesus. She's not illogical. She's not hallucinating. She knows that Jesus has died. She sees Jesus and assumes it must be a gardener. Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him and I will get him." She doesn't assume anything supernatural has or is taking place. All that Mary wants from these three men is some answers about where the body of Jesus is, where her master has been put. And then her master calls her by name. Jesus said to her, "Mary." She didn't realize until that moment something supernatural had taken place, was taking place. And now she can see him for who he really is. She turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. All of this fits with what Jesus has taught his disciples before this time. Let me read to you from John chapter 10. Jesus said this. He said, "The man who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The watchman opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep and my sheep know me, just as the Father knows me and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that are not of this sheep pen. I must bring them also. They too will listen to my voice, and there shall be one flock and one shepherd. The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again." See, Jesus knows his sheep and his sheep know him. He calls them by name. He lays down his life for the sheep and he takes it up again. That's what he told them before. John chapter 20, verse 16. Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic, Rabboni, which means teacher. Her master was crushed, and now he is miraculously whole, living, breathing. It's really him. She can hear his voice. And Jesus tells her what's happening next. Verse 17, Jesus said, Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Jesus has not only returned to the physical flesh and blood life he had before. In his body, he's going to go to God, to the Father of glory. He hasn't just come out of death, you see, revived for some time. He hasn't gone into death and come back out. He's gone into death and broken through it. He is entirely human, but a human who can never die again. And he is going to take this new humanity into the glory of God. Taking seriously what Jesus said in John chapter 10, he's doing this so he can lead his sheep there, to bring them into his humanity, his new restored humanity, to bring them to God's glory. His message to the disciples that morning was that he'd risen from death to be the great shepherd of the sheep, the one that would lead his people to God. And he's going ahead of them so that they can follow. Mary got up early to go to the tomb because she had a job to do. It was important work, vital for honouring her master, her Lord. And she went down in the pre-dawn light, disillusioned, disappointed and disheartened. How different it was then as the full day dawned. Now she has a job to do. Now she has important work to do, vital for honouring her master and her Lord. Verse 18, Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, I have seen the Lord. And she told them that he had said these things to her. As we reflect on that first Easter morning, it's not hard to understand why Christians down through the ages have celebrated Easter so heartily with such strong, sturdy joy. The risen Jesus shows us where our existence is headed if we are his sheep. We understand that we too are a sheep of this good shepherd. He laid down his life for us. He took it up again to lead us to glory. And he will bring us and our whole world to be the way it was always supposed to be. This is not an ignorant joy that sweeps problems aside as if they don't exist. Now this knows it matters a great deal. For example, how we treat God, how we treat each other, how we treat our environment. God takes our moral and our religious failings incredibly seriously. Jesus died because of them. But we should also know that there is nothing that we can do to be more secure in God than to trust Jesus. Christians realize that we are so much more flawed than we could ever know. And we are so much more welcome and secure in Christ who rose from the dead than we ever could have hoped for. Easter means we can take life in our world seriously, but confidently, joyfully. And not only are we joyful in how we approach life, we're joyful in how we approach death. It's not some ignorant or stoic joy. Jesus and his disciples knew all too well the pain and death that still mark our existence in this world. Death remains a part of it, but there is real hope in Jesus Christ. It's not wishful thinking. He disarmed death. Death has no real ultimate power over those who know that the shepherd has conquered it. Because of that first Easter morning, we have a joy that takes pain and death seriously, but knows that they're done away with. See, there's so much to celebrate at Easter, isn't there? We have time with family, we have lovely food, we have chocolate eggs, and more chocolate eggs. Now, Christians have given each other eggs down through the centuries as a sign of the new life that Jesus brings for hundreds and hundreds of years. But we know that Easter isn't about eggs. Easter is not about chocolate. Those things mark our joy, but our joy doesn't come from those things. The joy of Easter is about this decisive moment in history. Jesus, for our sake, took all sin and death upon himself and died, and then he broke through death. A physical, flesh and blood human lives right at this moment in the presence of God, and he stands ready to shepherd all who will trust him. And one day he'll bring all his sheep together, and we will share in his glorious life. Because Christ is risen. He's risen indeed. We're going to stand and sing to encourage one another. I know that my Redeemer lives.